The alchemy of doubt is what I would like to speak about. Alchemy is a kind of almost mythical practice or science where an element or metal of less value is changed into gold. With spiritual alchemy, we're talking about bringing out what is of more value than gold, what is of actual genuine value to life, which gold is not. So the alchemy of doubt. Gautam Buddha spoke in a lovely way about what we could call small doubt, doubt as an obstacle. A few days ago, I spoke about the obstacle of restlessness and the image that the Buddha gave for restlessness and freedom from restlessness, being a slave and being liberated from slavery. The image that is given for doubt is a really different kind of image from the other four hindrances. It's different from being in debt or having a sickness or being in prison or being a slave. Being a person of wealth and resources and entering a road that crosses a desert. This is the image that is given for doubt. What I'd like to call small doubt today. And somehow the need to cross that desert. And then having crossed it, coming to the other side. Suppose someone with wealth and property were to enter a road across a desert, but later on one would cross over the desert, safe and secure, with no loss to one's property. On considering this, one would be glad and full of joy. I love how they add that sort of obvious. Having realized that we crossed the desert and we survived and everyone's okay and we didn't lose anything, we didn't get attacked by robbers or sort of desert tigers or whatever, and we didn't run out of water. On considering this, we would be glad and full of joy. I love how the image itself is very powerful and given with just a few words, and then all the packaging around it. Does it need to be said that we would be glad and full of joy if we got across the desert? And then a little bit later, it said that release from doubt, or when we've purified the mind of small doubt, it's like being in a land of safety. So finally, we have the positive image and not just the negative image, the desert to cross. It isn't said what are the dangers that are in the desert. Desert means no water, so we can imagine it's dry. And one quality of doubt when it attacks is that kind of dryness. It can be like a fire burning us up, or it can just be a lack of juiciness. But the fact that we're relieved, apparently, when we get to the other side of the desert, that there's been no loss to our property, apparently there's some danger to our wealth, to our resources, in crossing the desert of doubt. And I love giving you the chance to know that there are these small images given in some of the Buddhist scriptures that are worth unpacking. The teachings in this way are called suttas, so it's threads. The teachings are powerfully packed into the smallest line possible. And it's worth spending some time digesting and letting it open out for us. So we have wealth and property, and we have to cross a desert. So what is the doubt that is being mentioned? It seems to me that when we're questioning ourselves or how we've spent our lives or the teachings that we've received, we're questioning our own sincerity or someone else's. The question is based on the assumption that something's wrong. We're not questioning tuning into our wealth. We're not questioning tuning into the richness of our experience. We're questioning tuning into a sense of danger, the danger in uncertainty. We're questioning coming out of a sense of lack rather than richness. And so an experience comes that's difficult. We feel confused, for example. Feeling confused maybe feels unpleasant, and it's easy that we jump to the assumption that unpleasant confusion is a problem, is wrong, and start questioning from there. Sometimes when we can't bear the difficulty, what happens is called blame. So there's a social scientist called Brené Brown who talks about blame as the natural outcome when we can't bear the pain. It naturally moves to blame, whether I blame myself or another. So then we're not just confused, but we're also blaming someone else or myself or everyone, life, God. And would it be possible to rewind and just come to the discomfort? Not assuming that it's problematic, but even possibly assuming that it's wealth, that it's richness, the discomfort of confusion. When we don't rewind back to the actual experience, just uncomfortable confusion or chaos that I think I can't handle, assuming that it's wrong to be confused, assuming also then that I should own it and then therefore hide it, protect it, hesitate, be hesitant in my life. What happens when we tune into the richness of confusion, not assuming that it's a problem, but remembering our actual past experience of having been confused? In our past experience of having been confused, what happened next? Isn't confusion often a sign of leaving behind a past framework and starting to be open, if we're open to the confusion, to new insight? If we're crossing a desert and we have only so much water, and at any point something can jump out at us and take what we have, what we want to do is keep going. If we get confused, we might need to stop and get our bearings in some wider way. But if we know where we're going, if we're on a road that crosses the desert, we need to keep going, assuming that confusion is part of our wealth. Knowing that a desert has to be crossed and we will be thirsty. There won't be places to stop necessarily and get comfort We're isolated and we're on the move. And we're aware of uncertainty and we don't have much water. The normal reaction when we're aware of uncertainty is to freak out. And to go against uncertainty instead of to work with it. So when we are able to work with uncertainty, we're not saying that things are certain, that there's a guaranteed outcome. We're agreeing that things are uncertain, that anything could happen. When we go against uncertainty out of fear, we're trying to suppress the nature of the situation. We're fighting the nature of our life. And we tend to grab the wrong map to guide us through the desert. We tend to grab an old map. We tend to grab a map about right and wrong. We tend to grab a map that makes us hesitate when we need to move and push forward when we need to pause. We're either over certain or we're over hesitant. And how much of our lives have we held back the truly living that's possible? So, for example, we've not been told that we're a talented artist. We've not been told that we're good with music or poetry or dance or paint. So we assume we're not, and we assume we would have to be. We would have to be talented to make something worthwhile. And so we're tuning into lack, we're tuning into not richness, we're tuning into poverty, and moving from there. And we end up hesitating our whole lives. And then the extra energy that builds up comes out in the certainty, the ambition, the pushiness. And if we again go to our actual experience, if we could take account of our actual experience, sticking with the example of art, even what art has reached you, it really doesn't matter if the artist is talented. In fact, sometimes the more talented the artist, sometimes the more fancy and the more showing off and the less art, the less meeting space. So we could recognize, oh, that is a beautiful voice, but it doesn't move me. I don't feel space for connection. The apparatus is good, yes. The song, And other times, sometimes presented as art, and sometimes someone might present it as, oh, I'm not an artist, but this is a poem that came to me. Or this is a drawing that just came through. And just that simplicity and honesty that's there allows a great space where both you and me feel our resources, our wealth. When someone is talented and knows they're talented and is moving from a place of being talented, that talent is mine, and the art comes from that mine-ness. I've lost touch with my richness. In order to appreciate that art, I have to be poor and let the art be what's rich. And when there's just more honesty and simplicity in great art by artists and non-artists alike, There's great space that allows us to fall into touch with our resources, with the simple richness of being human. We can feel for what kind of gestures happen inwardly. When there's an assumption that something's wrong and it's mine. You did it to me or I did it to me, but it's my problem. And it's wrong. What kind of doubt happens in that space, in that state? Just noticing, it's often a kind of top-down domination, trying to dominate the chaos. Or a reaching out, trying to get better. Trying to get outer confirmation. So when I'm doubting, what's an easy way to go, and it's the wrong road to cross the desert. If we really want to get across the desert, we need to stay on the road that leads across the desert and not the one that goes around for 40 years. When I'm doubting myself, is my experience valid? Is there some value to my experience? What's wrong with me? I'm such a loser, or whatever. After all these years of meditation, and still I'm afraid or angry or arrogant or whatever. When that thought and feeling and experience, which is like an attack, and it is like a dryness of a desert, the burning sun and the freezing cold of a desert. We do want to reach out for some credentials. We do want to reach out for someone to confirm, to give me permission to be okay. Very easily, we fly out of our experience trying to get some confirmation so that we can give ourselves permission to feel okay. We're embarrassed that after a year of meditation, 30 years of meditation or whatever, after receiving the highest teachings from the Dalai Lama 30 times or whatever, I still get upset when my mother says such and such a thing or whatever. What's wrong with me? This is not how it should be. We reach out for confirmation. We at least want to know, where am I on the map? Which is a valid enough question sometimes. Where am I on the map across the desert, the road across the desert? But we're asking someone else to place us on a map. So we've left our own map of our own experience. We've left our own chance to contact, to contain our own experience enough to feel it. And to know in our own experience that there isn't anything that leads away from liberation. So we want to know if I'm doing better or worse, or if I'm the same as someone else. And this is where we've stopped ourselves when we need to be walking across the desert. If we feel that movement in our mind and in our system, going for some kind of confirmation that I am better or worse or equal to, we've stopped walking on the road across the desert, and we don't have enough water if we stop for long? Can we let our thirst tell us, like shake us awake and get us walking again? Can we rewind back to some more original questions? Not assuming that something's wrong. When we hear ourselves asking myself or another person, is my experience okay? Is my experience valid? Is there okayness anyway? Then we start to get our feet walking again. We start to take our eyes off the map, get our bearings by the stars, and get our feet moving again. Is my experience okay is no longer saying my experience is not okay. Is there okayness despite my experience being terrible? Despite my experience going against what I think it should be. Can we move through the embarrassment and shame about our experience? Can we start with acceptance of our experience? We're in a desert. It's really hot and then it's really cold. And any landmarks are shifting all the time. So even if we've been through it before, we need to feel our feet on the ground now. Can we let the questions continue to unravel the tightness and the jumping out for confirmation? Is my experience okay? Is there okayness despite this experience? Is this experience mine? Is this experience me? And then we start to find a way to cooperate with uncertainty. We're not sure. We can't be sure if it's my experience, if it's me. It's something in the field of awareness that's happening that I in no way could call myself the owner of it. I'm sensitive to it, but I can't honestly call myself its owner. I don't own it. I don't own the rage and the panic. I don't own the insecurity, the loneliness, or whatever it is that's caused us to start doubting. Whatever it is that seems to stop us from feeling the juiciness of our life. So without pretending that uncertainty is certain, can we find something in us that actually agrees with uncertainty and even likes it? So in our experience even of our body, in our experience of anything, we can contact uncertainty. We can contact the origin of our questioning. It's right to question. Our experience asks for questions. Our experience is a question that can't be answered. Am I alone or are we together? Am I separate or not separate? Is my image of my body more true, or is my feeling of my body more true And why do they not quite match? Why do they not quite fit together? Why is the body that's supposed to be solid ungraspable? And not running to assume that there's something wrong with me, that I experience my body as ungraspable. When people give the meditation instructions, be aware of your breath, just very simply, bare sensations, just the breath. It sounds like a nice, neat package that should be easy to catch. And when it isn't, for many people, for some people it's easy. For most people, it's not easy at first. It's not your fault for many reasons. Partly, the mind is trained not to go where we ask it to. The mind is trained to be distracted and to go out. The mind is trained to concentrate on certain things, depending on our past. The mind naturally pays attention to some things, and we can't stop it from paying attention to some things. But we can train the mind to start to pay attention to the breath. And still, it's not what we expected. They said it would be simple and easy and just bare experience, the breath. Just the breath. And still there isn't anything to hold on to. And what's wrong with me that I can't just catch that exhale? Just one exhale, please. Because it isn't anything. It's very definitely happening, and we can very precisely feel it, and it's very alive, and it will never happen the same again. And it isn't anything quite. It is and it isn't. So our experience asks for question mark. Not necessarily mental questions. But the question mark somehow knows well how to work with uncertainty, to work together with uncertainty. To accept that there's not any part of the breath that I can catch. And there's also not any part of the breath that I need to necessarily miss. I could feel the whole thing intimately. Without making it a thing. Without knowing what's going to happen next. Without letting my past out-breath intimidate the next out-breath. So I'm not letting my expectation get in the way of that intimacy. So crossing the desert, we start to find our alchemy, the alchemy of the human being, with the question mark. First of all, accepting that somehow, why, question mark, I don't know. The desert needs to be crossed. The desert comes along. And although in the Buddhist tradition it's normally called a hindrance, an obstacle, something that gets in the way of our path, in this case, the obstacle is a road through a desert. It's something I find a little different from the other obstacles. And also, similar to the other obstacles in that, when we're working together to cooperate with uncertainty, we're not against uncertainty, we're not against the ungraspability of our experience. We accept. The coming of the desert is a sign that we're going deeper. This is my experience. The coming of any of these obstacles that come in a human being, a sense of lack or debt that wants to get what others have, wants to get what's outside, a sense of ill will that's like a sickness, a lack of energy that's like imprisonment, restlessness that's like being a slave, and doubt that's like a road through a desert. The part of us that accepts the uncertainty and the ungraspability, the undefinability of us. Can feel the flow of our path going right through the obstacle, working with the obstacle, as a purifying of the mind, in the language of the sutta, of the teaching. And we start to come to understand what practice is for. As we cross the desert. And what that means is we start to experience alchemy. We start to understand what spiritual practice does. There's a training of the mind-heart. So we start to relax some of the fixed views. We start to allow more question marks. We start to let our experience speak for itself. We start to notice how much painful conditioning impacts on our daily experience. And we start to find something other than that to move through our lives. Training the mind to be more, there's a word used, malleable. So it would be like having clay that we need to warm up, so that it's more flexible. We can shape it in different ways. It's not hard. Letting the mind come into its brightness is a word that's used in the text. Why? Not just for that, not just for itself, not just for its own sake, not just to have a mind that we can shape into whatever shape we want. That's not the point. That would be no different from acrobatics, which is fine if it's fun for you, if that's your practice, great. But not leading to liberation necessarily. When the mind doesn't respond in the same way to the hindrances, when the mind doesn't take things so personally, when the mind accepts the richness of experience and accepts uncertainty, what else is revealed. So that is our practice, is to let go of what's in the way of experiencing what is. As it is. Our practice isn't to create what is. Our practice isn't to force what is to show itself. Does that make sense? Yeah. Is there any question yet? And it's just curious to me that Gautam Buddha used this image of a person of wealth and property entering a road across a desert for doubt. Maybe we can feel how, even when we're not in touch with our wealth, with the richness of us as a human being, even if I think I'm poor and I just see myself, feel myself crossing the desert And my experience is that I have nothing. I'm just a waste. I've wasted my life. Or someone else has wasted my life for me. When the doubt attack is strong. When the desert road is long. My fear of crossing the desert is because I do have something of value, otherwise I wouldn't care what happened to me. So through the fear, we could actually trace back to there is something of value in me just because I'm a human being. And so it could happen that through doubting, we start to come into touch with what is of value that can't be lost. What's important anyway, even if I wasted my whole life till this point? So when we can kind of swing with the doubt, it's not always possible when it is attacking, but sometimes we could accept, okay, what if I wasted my whole life doing this meditation thing? And either I had the wrong teachers, or I took the best teachings in the wrong way, or whatever. Or it's just too hard to do, it can't be done in one life. We're still a human being, so give it all up. Okay, I'm not saying stop meditating. I'm not saying stop anything. But what if so far till now I have wasted my life? Through my fault or someone else's fault. So just, what if the doubt is true? So what? So what, and what then? So this beautiful moment that is the land of safety. What would I do, and what do I do anyway? What would I do now? What is my best guess? If all that has been unvaluable, has been unuseful, has been harmful, what does aliveness do without hope, without help? For no reason, not to get something. We end up in the same place. We end up in the place through extreme lack, extreme not having, not enough. Something's really, really wrong. We end up with the ground of our lives of why not? Another kind of question mark. What moves for no reason? Not to get anything. It just moves anyway. We wouldn't call it, but it is a pure act of generosity. Undirected. And therefore unlimited. And so our spiritual practice gets refined through doubting so that we understand what its function is, to clear the mind so that what is shows up to us, is available to us. So what is true, but it's unhelpful to me if I'm not in touch with it, if I don't know it. If it's not available to me, I'm not available to it. Our practice clears the way for what is to be available, and for me to be available to it. That can allow us to have a different relationship to teachers and practices and past. Love moves us. Or no reason moves us. Life moves us. we can take it more lightly. We didn't come into a binding agreement anymore with the teacher, okay, I'll devote myself to this teacher so that I'll get enlightenment. I'll devote myself to these practices so that I'll get enlightenment. Giving up the map of where enlightenment is and where I am is also giving up the mindset that we are separate and that there's distance. And so we come to great doubt in the Zen tradition. In some Zen traditions, they talk about great doubt. And so we come from the question of what is wholesome? What is helpful? I don't know. I got lost. They were saying that was helpful, I found this was helpful, but then now it isn't anymore. Can you tell me what's wholesome? And through practice, we come into touch often enough and long enough with those movements of for no reason, with no map, not making me better or worse or equal to so-and-so or such-and-such. And we start to be able to slide into a subtle but also deeply natural attraction to the wholesome, attraction to what helps, inner or outer. And it allows us tremendous freedom to accept our experience as it is and to let it take us deeply, to take techniques and teachings lightly, staying in touch with the richness that is with us, that we don't have to make, we don't have to make it up, we don't have to create it. It already is. And so what's the difference in that, the two kinds of doubt in terms of our felt sense of them, the inner gesture that happens, let's say. When we're doubting and assuming something's wrong, something's missing, what does it feel like? And when there's a letting go of what's in the way of experiencing directly what is, what does that feel like? So just a few small examples, so it doesn't sound like something that will only happen once in your lifetime 20 years from now. It happens every day. We may be walking along, and we're very much with our eyes and our seeing in the front of our body, maybe, and we're really directed. And then something happens, maybe we realize we have more time than we thought, or we meet the person we were trying to meet somewhere else. Here they are, for example, just random example. And then, I don't have to go somewhere here. Oh, here's the meeting right here. Or just suddenly there's time, I'm not in a hurry. And sometimes just naturally we just slow down or even stop. And then there starts to maybe be more possibility for hearing as well as seeing. Not only seeing, also hearing. Not only listening to something and the objectness of the sound, but a kind of all-round receptivity to sound can happen. That's one kind of symptom or sign for some people who are more visual or who have had that typical modern training to be more visual. For those who have the extreme sensitivity in the ears, it might be more of the migration of tension and attention to the hearing in the head into the body. But there's often a kind of sense of all-around openness. And as I was arriving, coming from Lucknow to Varanasi and Sarnath, I suddenly remembered the Ashokan pillar with the four lions on the top, which is on every piece of money, I think, that we have in India. So you've seen it, even if you didn't notice. You can look on your money. I think it's there. There's a lion on the top of a tall pillar, stone, made of stone, carved, and a lion looking in the four directions. Four lions. It's a kind of readiness towards all directions. A lion-like readiness. A lion-like alertness, we can say. With the small doubt, there tends to be the over-alertness, where things are shocking or things are blocked out, and it's all too much. And with the great doubt, there's a kind of softening that's possible. Through the softening, this empowerment that opens us to the whole of our experience. In a way that's alert like a lion, so the lion could eat anything. The lion is the one big cat that cooperates. The other big cats hunt alone. This is a lion facing all directions. And what I love about the big cats is their alertness without the over-alertness, without the tension. The alertness with also utter ease on planet Earth. It allows us to then kind of actively doubt. Doubt from the inside, not have it, that attack happen that eats us up. But feeling hungry sometimes, and most of the time just lying around. But with an openness to the whole of our experience. So sometimes from inside there's a bubbling up and a realization. That's one way that great doubt works. Sometimes there's a kind of softening back and down that just reveals what's important anyway, what's important no matter what has value. Regardless of the market. And so there starts to be a confidence with the great doubt of what is this life? What is this experience? Great in the sense of going as deeply as possible, as widely as possible. And as friendly in a lion-like way as possible. We start to actually, our whole system starts to kind of get it. That what is. And even if our connection to what is, our receptivity to what is, our receiving of it, our understanding of it, even if that's shaky, on and off, vulnerable, I love how Jay Krishnamurti says, meditation, as love, is as vulnerable as a flower, so delicate, can be crushed in an instant. By its very vulnerability, it is indestructible. One way to take this is our connection to what is. So what is, there's nothing that could destroy it. The destruction would be part of what is. There's no escape from what is. Our connection to what is, which we might call meditation or we might call love, Krishnamurti calls meditation the movement of love. The fact that our connection to it is vulnerable is shaky. Our experience of what is has uncertainty in it. The very fact that what is ungraspable is what helps it be indestructible. Nothing could reach it, hold on to it, and tear it apart. It's ungraspable. Our connection to it is shaky because the slightest discriminating thought, the slightest sense of right or wrong, better or worse, or even equal to, as Gautam Buddha points out, destroys our connection to what is. It doesn't destroy what is, it destroys our connection to what is. And that also makes it easy and simple. Easy and simple, not just simple. The slightest discriminating thought is all that's in the way. I'm right, you're wrong. This technique is right, that technique is wrong, etc. Why am I saying it's not only simple but easy when we're not doing it much? We're not often washing away that discriminating thought that makes it impossible for us to be in contact with what is. It is easy in a moment, to disbelieve that thought, to feel underneath that thought, so to speak, to feel that that thought also came out of, is also part of what is. So the lions finding that nothing's in the way. When we can doubt our right, wrong thinking, when we can doubt that things should be different and not stop, not block a response to what is happening. When we can doubt that there's anything that doesn't lead to liberation, when we could doubt that there's anything that isn't part of what is, when we could doubt that there's anything that doesn't show its nature to us, we could doubt that there's anything that's not our kin, our family, when we can doubt certainty, we can doubt lack, we can doubt problem. Through taking account of our own experience that when we believe in problem and react to problem, we make more problem. But when we allow what is, including situations that are happening that need response, when we can allow our response just to come through, we're not creating a courage that's based on fear. We're not pushing. We're allowing an aliveness of response through a human being in a way that has much more intelligence than our thinking mind has. the response has beauty in it, and lightness, and flexibility, readiness, power. And because I'm not trying to enforce something to happen, enforce a result, enforce a fixed view, I'm trusting that this love is genuine and is moving through a human being, and that's what happens. When I've doubted through to come to where I know I'm not making this up, that's the land of safety for a human being. Any questions or comments before we close? I'll try.
Place of safety.
Yeah. When we found ourselves trying to face fear, trying to be courageous, and then we've noticed that it was a courage that was built out of fear. And then we've also noticed that there is another kind of courage that also sometimes happens. And we allow that deeply natural, very subtle attraction to the wholesome happen. So we feel drawn into that genuine, unconstructed courage that arises in a human being in response to danger, in response to difficulty. We're unveiling an intelligence that's not about my agenda, it's not about myself, and it's not about what I know. And that intelligence allows us to experience what came in the group today in this togetherness. Not someone's problem or difficulty, but in this togetherness. So, compassion. And that being in this together has so much power and strength and security, not in the way that we planned, but it's the land of safety in the phrase of the Buddhist text. Say again? What do I mean by saying the question mark goes together?
Or in agreement, or in good company with the insecurity.
Mm-hmm. So I think I said the question mark goes well with the fact of uncertainty. The question mark also goes well with insecurity. What is insecure? What am I insecure about? What am I protecting? What am I hiding? Is it mine? Is it being protected by this defensiveness, etc.? So the question mark goes well with insecurity. What is the root of that insecurity? And what happens when I kind of face the fact of vulnerability, uncertainty? What I find is that it's important that there's uncertainty that allows creativity. So then we can be in this together. And there's the possibility of freshness and care. Arising like a fragrance off of us. Maybe just end with a small, strange example. There's a doctor named Dr. Sam Parnia who's studying what he calls after-death experiences. So we've been calling them all along near-death experiences. But as a doctor, he's working with people who have had heart attacks, so their body has died. And then through advanced techniques of bringing people back to life, bringing the body back to life, in 1 out of 1,000 cases, someone remembers what they experienced. So it's still a new science. But everyone who comes back and remembers says there's peace, and there's light, and there's love. Except those who committed suicide, where it's unpleasant. So this is a different category. It's not in his study. It's not, you can't have a heart attack on purpose. It would be a little hard. Maybe you could by stopping your medication, but it's a little different. But he's saying, I want people to know this, and that can help us by having someone else's experience go against the biological reaction to death, so we can feel something deeper than biology that could just say, okay, there's uncertainty now. I don't know what happens after death, the ultimate uncertainty.
Yeah, but these people, they get...
But facing it, hearing that, it can help us drop down somewhere more creative that doesn't take uncertainty as a problem, but goes into the flow of uncertainty. So just like the gap at the end of the out-breath allows the in-breath to come in. Without the gap, we're stuck. May all beings be happy in a happiness that's a kind of, in the words of Mary Oliver, a kind of holiness, happiness for no reason. May our practice and our lives be of benefit for all, including ourselves. May our practice and our lives contribute to the momentum towards liberation everywhere.